Hi, I'm Ken.
And I am Dee.
And this is Antiques Freaks.
Always a podcast.
For antiques.
And freaks.
This week, we will be returning to the realm of publishing.
Oh?
Oh, yes.
We're going to Cranford?
No. We are dipping back just for a little bit into dime novels.
Oh, boy!
If you recall, they are the 19th century version of Netflix in America. Cheap stories coming out weekly on shitty, shitty paper.
Oh boy, wow, you're really coming for Netflix on that one. I was about to make fun of you for sounding like everyone's, like, literature professor in freshman year of college. We're just like, books are what people had before movies. But then you just turned it into a savage takedown.
You know, Dickens was kind of like your Hulu.
No, Dickens was like my narrative podcast.
Sorry, are you trying to suggest that Dickens was your Black Tapes?
Dickens was my Black Tapes, yeah, in every way.
Dickens, a Black Tapes for the 19th century. But we're not fucking talking about him.
We're not.
We're pushing him aside for the moment, because now we're in the 20th century.
Oh, we're in the future.
We are. And dime novels have been murdered by pulp paperbacks.
Oh boy. Did you say murdered because they frequently featured murder as an intrigue?
They do. Because they are detective stories and adventure stories and fantasy and some romance and westerns and certain other genres as well. But first, what is a pulp paperback?
It is very mushy.
Yes, it is a very squishy paperback.
It's what you get when you juice a book.
Now do you prefer your liquid book, pulp, or no pulp?
Always the pulp.
I prefer my book juice pulpy. No, they're called pulp paperbacks after the paper they're printed on.
Oh, not entirely a joke then.
No, not entirely a joke. It's pulp paper because it's cheap, squishy pulp wood used to create the paper, and it is not designed to last longer than 1 year.
Wow.
Kind of like how newsprint starts to degrade the day after because you don't need it after that.
Yeah, yeah.
Pulp paperbacks are 25 cents a piece, give or take. And they're designed to be discarded after you read them. So you are buying them in places like bus stations or train stations or drugstores or newsstands because you need your 20th century Netflix just to tide you over for the next hour or two.
Oh, so like John Grisham.
Yes, they are the precursor to airport reads.
Yeah.
They explode in popularity after World War II, partially because since they're cheap, easy to carry around, they were very popular with the military.
Oh, yeah.
And that popularity came home with the soldiers. So now, civilians are also very much into pulp paperbacks.
Well, also because it's just kind of sexy, right?
A little sexy. Because in 1950, speaking of sexy military, we get a pulp paperback titled Women's Barracks.
Uh-oh.
By Teresca Torres, published through Gold Medal Books.
That's a really cool name.
Right? Who is Teresca Torres?
I'd like to know.
She was born in 1920 in Paris. She was a Jewish refugee from the Nazi occupation of France. Her family fled to England. And in 1939, at the age of 19, she enlisted in Charles de Gaulle's Free French Forces Volontaires Francais Corps and worked in their London headquarters as a secretary.
Damn.
And while she works there, she keeps a diary.
Is it a sexy diary?
A little bit. Her first husband, George Torres, dies fighting Nazis in the war. After the war in 1948, she marries her second husband, Mayor Levin. Levin urges her to publish her Free French Forces diary, and she does so in 1950 through Gold Medal Books under the title Women's Barracks.
Oh.
Now, she's French. Obviously fluent in English, but French first and foremost. So she's used to writing in French and communicating with other French people, by and large.
I follow you so far.
So Women's Barracks is not the title she gave it.
Uh-oh.
And the manuscript she gave her publisher isn't quite the one that made it to print.
Uh-oh.
So this is the first pulp novel with lesbian themes.
Oh, she didn't mean for it to be there.
The lesbian content was intentional, but it was not intended to be the selling feature.
Right. So she did write some in.
Oh, yes, because it's the diary of her experience in the Free French Forces, which means it's her diary of her experience with a bunch of other late teens and 20-somethings in the fucking Blitz who all thought they were about to die, so they were all constantly fucking.
Wow.
Because there are a bunch of young adults in Blitz London.
Yeah. No, I got it. Yeah. I'm following.
So, there's a certain motivation to live fast, die young, leave a beautiful corpse.
Right.
As the first pulp novel with lesbian themes, it depicts a lesbian relationship witnessed by Taurus in the Free French Forces that tragically ended in the suicide of one of the women involved.
Aww.
It becomes the first runaway best-selling pulp title. Up to this point, pulp as a genre sold well, like in general, but like no individual title was carrying the entire industry.
Okay.
This sold 2 million copies in the first 5 years.
Oh.
People liked Women's Barracks. And I also feel like I should mention, like, every single printing has a different cover, but they are all just paintings of women stripping out of uniforms and looking at each other like, hey, check this out. Am I right?
So set the precedent for lesbian pulp there, too.
A little bit, yeah.
Because I was going to say, that sounds like...
bits.
Every lesbian pulp I've seen is just a woman saucily unclasping her bra and looking at another woman.
Yeah, no, it does set that precedent. 4.5 million copies sell in total.
Oh my god.
It's translated into 13 languages, not including French.
It never makes it into French?
No, because in France, she publishes her actual diary because it's already in French.
Oh.
And the French, I'm not going to say they're more used to lesbians, but like, sexual content isn't immediately a kick in the face to them.
Yeah, yeah. It's libertines are from France for a reason.
Yeah. Speaking of differing attitudes between the French and the Americans regarding sexual topics, in 1952, the House Select Committee on Current Pornographic Materials singles out Women's Barracks as an example of how pulp fiction promotes moral degeneracy.
Yeah, nothing as degenerate as fighting the Nazis. The woman's a national treasure.
She really is.
International treasure, yeah. I'm not from France, so.
Torres, to this day, doesn't get why her book caused such an uproar.
She's still alive?
She had interviews as recently as 2015.
Oh, wow.
So I'm holding out hope. While the book does contain affairs between women, it also contains a lot of the same stuff between a lot of people, regardless of gender, because, as I said, there were a bunch of 20-somethings in London during the Blitz, and they all thought they were about to die, so fuck it, bone everyone.
So not to be like Captain Grimsby of the Grim SS, but it seems like it was not cool that America sensationalized what was essentially like what seems like it was originally
a refugee survival story.
Yeah, really fraught portrait of what it's like to survive in a time where you probably wouldn't.
Yeah, almost as if that was super slimy of them.
Yeah, it like gross.
Anyway, Torres concludes that Americans are prudes.
Well, you know, she's not wrong.
Yeah.
We did have most of the Puritans.
So many fucking Puritans. Thus begins the lesbian pulp novel boom.
Oh boy.
Strap in, kids.
Strap on. I am so sorry. You gotta set that up.
Oh, yes, indeed. So, lesbian pulp. D, you already have kind of an idea of what this looks like. It is lurid cover art of stereotypical 50s women, like, unclasping their very conical bras.
Yeah. Highly Madonna.
Most of these books are written by male authors for male consumption. Because, of course. Along with straight-up porno fiction, pulp publishers put out fake sex studies and case histories inspired by Kinsey.
Yeah, yeah, those continue to plague, like, the human history of sexuality.
It can't be obscene if it's for science.
It can. Because it's just your dumb ass writing gross porn.
For example, author Lawrence Block wrote under many pen names, including Andrew Shaw and Dr. Benjamin Morse. And he combined the two when he had the protagonist of Butch by Andrew Shaw read The Lesbian by Dr. Benjamin Morse.
What in the fuck?
So what he did was he wrote a quote-unquote nonfiction book about lesbians. And then he wrote a novel about lesbians, where he had a fake lesbian read his fake book about fake lesbians. And recommend it to other fake lesbians.
Talk about establishing a provenance. My book can't be bullshit. Look, this fake lesbian's reading it. What? Hey, wait, another question. Can you just take up a pen name where you call yourself a doctor?
Yeah.
This changes everything. I'm about to become Dr. Phil.
He's already doing a thing.
He's not a doctor. Is that how he got away with it?
Yes. No, he actually has, like, a doctorate in something unrelated to anything he does.
Weird.
I know, right? It's almost as though television's a lie. Read more books.
Shit. But not Dr. Phil's, because he's also lying to you. Instead, you should read this doctor's. A lesbian read it. It's gotta be good.
A fake lesbian endorsed it. It has to be.
For lesbian, he also wrote. Man, how proud of himself was he for that little goddamn...
Listen, like... I'm proud of him. Because that is audacity of the highest order.
Can you imagine? Like, I really do want to write a book. And then later write a book where they're just like, have you read this book? It's incredible.
It's like, imagine if, like, in Lady Windermere's fan, like, Oscar Wilde had a scene where the characters just talk about how much they loved The Portrait of Dorian Gray.
Yeah, just like, what a good book. A really hot, sexy, cool guy must have wrote this.
Anyway. However, there are some notable exceptions to the by men for men rule of lesbian pulp fiction.
Those are the ones I'm most excited to know about.
They're the ones that make up the other 9 pages of these notes. We begin, still in 1952, with Spring Fire by Vin Packer.
Everything about that sounds so cool.
Published through Gold Medal Books, seeking to capitalize on the success of Women's Barracks. Who is Vin Packer?
The coolest?
Vin Packer is the pen name of Mary Jane Meeker.
I can see why she adopted the pen name.
Meeker first became interested in writing when she realized pen names were a thing. She was excited by the idea. It took a minute for that to sink in, huh?
I really did. I was just like, wait, what? What? Like, wait, I don't have to use my, like, I was at the tail end of the joke I just made about her unfortunate name. Just like, what? I don't have to go by this. Nobody has to know.
She was excited by the idea of creating multiple personas to write under.
Bless her.
She asked her parents to send her to a boarding school when she heard a rumor that lesbian stuff happened at boarding school.
Oh, Lady Meeker.
She was suspended her senior year for creating a dartboard out of photos of faculty members.
She's the coolest.
She fucking rules. Post-college, she worked as a proofreader for Gold Medal Books and started writing mystery novels under the name Vin Packer. She also pretended to be a literary agent, using all of her own pseudonyms as her clients, thus cutting out the middlemen and submitting her own manuscripts to publishing houses.
Fucking legendary? Yes, I'm a literary agent. I represent all these illustrious authors who, may I mention, are incredibly sexy and engaging.
Dr. Benjamin Morse wishes he could.
Dr. Benjamin Morse is...
amateur. Fucking amateur hour.
Goddamn amateur hour. He didn't even know how far he could go.
As for her personal life, she dated men to meet the expectations of family, friends, society, etc. because she was growing up in the 40s and living in the 50s.
Yeah.
But she knew herself to be a lesbian the entire time. She had a 2-year romantic relationship with fellow writer Patricia Highsmith. More on that later.
Okay.
Meanwhile, in 1952... the editor of her Vin Packer Mysteries notes runaway sales success of Women's Barracks and asks Mary Jane to write a lesbian book.
Was Mary Jane Meeker just like, okay, I want to know if she just lifted her eyebrows like, okay.
I'm going to have to go pretty far out of my comfort zone for this one, buddy, but I'll do it for you. You know how I love that pulp money.
Yeah, just like, well, it's going to be rough.
I guess I'll just have to do some research.
I don't want to sell this character.
Anyway. To quote Wikipedia, it was released as a pulp novel solely because of its content, which is like, all right.
Okay.
The plot of Spring Fire is Susan Mitch Mitchell, an awkward college freshman, falling in love with her older and wiser sorority sister, Lita.
Ooh.
Quick trigger warning.
Oh, yeah, it's the 50s.
It's the 50s. The protagonist Mitch is raped by a fraternity brother, and her seeking comfort in Lita's arms is what pushes their relationship from pining to actualization.
Well, you know.
The 50s! The 50s. It also ends with one half of the relationship institutionalized, and the other declaring she never actually loved girls in the first place, and going on to make new friendships slash relationships more in line with what mid-century America demands of its young women.
The 50s.
The 50s were a mistake.
If you ever come up to me and tell me that the 50s were the best decade for anything other than the furniture, I will fucking straight up slap your mouth.
I'm also going to blame the furniture for the homophobia.
I don't think that's very fair.
Disagree. Meanwhile, why was this book such a downer? One, the 50s. Two, remember that mention of the House Select Committee?
Oh.
In 1952?
Yeah, you did say something
about that. The same year that this book comes out? Bringing up the book that this book is based on?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the books were shipped through the United States Postal Service, they had to conform to obscenity laws.
Of course.
Therefore, homosexuality could not be portrayed as, quote, attractive or in any positive light whatsoever. Moreover, Meeker's editor specifically told her that by the end of the book, one of the leads had to overtly reject lesbianism and the other one, quote, must be sick or crazy. Dude, you're making an amazing face right now.
Well, it's just, you know, every time I run into something like this, I think about all of those goddamn assheads who are just like, censorship, because you tell them not to say a slur. And then, but then you're just like...
No, this is what censorship actually looks like, jackass.
Yeah, real censorship looks like this.
Yeah, it's not you not being allowed to say the N-word. Fuck off. Anyway.
Yeah, just every time I just like immediately just like, I'm also gonna slap those people in the mouth.
We're gonna commit to a lot of mouth slapping in today's episode.
Line up behind the Denny's, everybody.
Slap an hour. Alright. Springfire had 3 printings and sold 1.5 million copies in its first year. So, 75% of the sales in 1 year that Women's Barracks had in 5 years.
Oh my god.
Not even remotely fucking around.
Jeez.
And also, more than other notable and more literary fare released that same year, including The Postman Always Rings Twice by James M. Cain.
No way!
And My Cousin Rachel by Daphne du Maurier.
Wow!
Which is possibly ironic, given what was now known about du Maurier's relationships with other women, and the overtly homoerotic tones of her work, especially in Rebecca.
Yeah.
Lesbians outselling lesbians. Best race!
Yeah. I'm just picturing them locking arms and fist pumping, personally, but...
I mean, you know. Beyond the cash money results, Meeker also receives an overwhelming response from other women-loving women.
Oh.
Because, at this point in history, the publishing industry didn't consider the gay audience to be a real market. And let's be real, the publishing industry barely considers gay people a market even now.
Well, yeah.
Meeker got boxes of mail from women thrilled to see their lives reflected in media, even with a downer ending.
I was gonna say, like, even with the downer, it's probably the first time they saw it.
It's the first time you see anyone like you anywhere in your culture.
Yeah.
Because the LGBT community has been desperate for representation basically ever since the first LGBT person was born. Not that I'm bitter.
Yeah, I'm not detecting any in this episode.
Speaking of gay people, in 1955, Meeker reads The Homosexual in America by Donald Webster Corey. It is a nonfiction book about gay men.
In which a gay man reads a book.
In which a gay man reads a novel about gay men that somehow speaks to him. Nah, it's just more case studies bullshit. But she is inspired to write a corresponding nonfiction book about lesbians based on her own experiences and those of women she knew in her community. So, a lesbian is actually writing the lesbian case study book for once.
That's great.
And she ends up writing 5 of these books under the name Ann Eldridge. In 1955, we get We Walk Alone. 1958, We Too Must Love. 1960, Carol in a Thousand Cities. That title will become resonant in a minute. 1963, We Two Won't Last. And 1972, Take a Lesbian to Lunch.
Don't mind if I do.
Let's go. These books are very controversial, both inside and outside of the lesbian community. The Daughters of Bilitis are, in particular, not amused. The Daughters of Bilitis do not like the self-loathing tone of the books, because they apparently forgot that it was the 50s. But they also have literally no idea who Ann Eldridge is because it's a pseudonym. So they're just filling their own zines and magazines and literary publications with just like rapid fire angry letters back and forth about who is this bitch and why is she blowing up our spot.
Oh, man, the way Meeker's career starts and then continues is whole, like, because she's just like, wait, I'm practically invisible with the pseudonym. And then it just like, yeah. Yeah.
Pseudonyms for everyone. One contributor to the Daughters of Bilitis magazine, The Latter, accused Anne Bannon of being Aldrich.
Anne Bannon, that name is familiar.
More on Anne Bannon later.
Okay.
In 1958, Meeker publishes The Evil Friendship. I'm including this one because I'm a murderino. It's a fictionalized and sensationalized account of the Parker Holm murder.
Oh.
For those of you who don't know, that was when 2 teenage girls who may or may not have been in lesbians murdered one of the girls' mothers because they erroneously believed that the murder would prevent their being separated.
Yes, spoiler alert, really fascinating case.
Didn't work out for them that way.
No, they got arrested.
It was also dramatized in the 1994 Peter Jackson film Heavenly Creatures, arguably more accurately even in that, because Meeker wildly fictionalized and sensationalized it. And, fun fact, one of the teen murderers grew up to become murder mystery novelist Ann Perry. Speaking of hiding behind a pseudonym...
Yeah! You just blown up Anne... Well, I mean, everyone knows that that was Anne
Perry. Everyone knows now. It's the internet age. But I just don't want anyone to forget that Anne Perry straight up killed a woman.
Yeah, it was... It's a very bizarre... That was... They had, like, a... They had that, like, this fantasy world that they had been building together.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I remember reading it and being very surprised at how much it kind of... This is a side beat, but how much it, like, the same thing could happen now. With, like, the concept of, like, internet friendships and the way so much of it revolves over, like, shared fantasy.
When the Slenderman stabbing happened, I was very much reminded of this case. Because exactly. It strikes a lot of the same points.
Yeah, just that, like, getting lost in this intense fantasized friendship. Anne Perry's always claimed that it wasn't a lesbian thing. I'm gonna take her word at that because she was there. But, you know, at the time, it was an intense friendship that made people wonder.
Yeah.
Very intense friendship. Murder your mother intense.
Yeah. Meanwhile, back in 1952.
I don't want to be here.
We're gonna be in 1952 for a while. I'm sorry.
Sucks and the furniture's all round.
I know. The furniture is awful, and so is the homophobia.
I'm pretty sure some of the furniture designers were gay people.
Refuse to believe.
I'm gonna do a
because gay people have taste.
I'm gonna do a retaliatory episode on 50s furniture. I'm sorry.
I'm going to die. 1952, The Price of Salt by Claire Morgan, a.k.a. Patricia Highsmith, is published in hardcover.
Ooh.
Why are we bringing this book up if it's not a pulp paperback? The name Patricia Highsmith.
I did.
As the name of the woman who had a 2-year relationship with Meeker.
Oh, yeah.
Interesting. Who is Patricia Highsmith?
Tell me more.
She is the author of, amongst a lot of other books, Strangers on a Train, which became an early Alfred Hitchcock film.
Right.
And The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh my god, really?
Really.
That's a very homoerotic story.
You're gonna notice some beats and themes in Highsmith's work. Because The Price of Salt is about a woman working in a department store who falls in love with a customer in a mink coat. A female customer.
Oh.
It's based on Highsmith's lived experience of working in a department store to earn money for therapy sessions to help her stop being a lesbian.
Man, if that ain't relatable.
Right? She gave up on therapy and embraced the lesbian and wrote The Price of Salt.
Nice.
It is unique amongst Highsmith's work for several reasons. The characters have the most explicit sex lives out of all of her books. It is the book with no violent crime. It is the only book about lesbians. And is the only book with a happy ending.
Aw, you did it.
And thus everyone loses their goddamn minds over it.
Well.
Because there are lesbians and they're not dead. What the fuck?
Yeah, they don't regret it.
So, in 1953, it is republished in paperback format and sells 1 million copies. Highsmith, like Meeker, starts receiving fan mail from fellow lesbians. To quote Highsmith, many of the letters that came to me carried such messages as, "Yours is the first book like this with a happy ending. We don't all commit suicide and lots of us are doing fine."
Aww. It's true.
It's true. But wait. Price of Salt and Spring Fire came out in the same year. How come Price of Salt can have a happy ending, but not Spring Fire?
Self-publishing?
Oh, no. Highsmith is a literary fiction author.
Oh, that's right.
Which means The Price of Salt is a real book printed on real paper with a hard cover, as mentioned earlier. And, as such, it is delivered to stores by a private company hired by the publishing house and not the U.S. Postal Service. Which means it is unaffected by U.S. Postal Service obscenity laws. So Uncle Sam can suck it!
It's that thing, I'm getting mad about it again, where people just look... old government dipping its toe into my rights when they're talking about, like, bump stocks or some dumb shit. It's like, this is what it actually fucking looks like. I think I'm just gonna keep... I'm sorry that I keep railing on that point.
Speaking of censorship, throughout the mid-50s, quote, several First Amendment obscenity trials occur, including Roth versus the United States and a case surrounding Allen Ginsberg's Howl.
Oh, of course.
Of course. But the result is that the United States Postal Service takes a fucking chill pill.
Oh, thank God.
Which means lesbians can now have happily ever afters in pulp fiction.
Yeah! Let's get on it.
Which paves the way for 1957's Odd Girl Out by Anne Bannon.
I know that book!
Published through Gold Middle Books. Who is Anne Bannon?
Tell me.
Well, she was mentioned earlier as a possible real person behind Aldrich. She is not!
So many layers of mystery.
She is the pseudonym of Anne Weldy. Hey, remember how Mary Jane Meeker got all those letters from lesbians thrilled to finally have their lives reflected in fiction?
Was Anne Weldy one of them?
Yes! She wrote to Meeker asking for advice on how to get her own lesbian fiction published.
She's like, first dismantle the U.S. Postal Service.
Meeker hooked her up with Goldman and Books.
Oh.
Her own publisher. Would that it were so simple today.
Yeah, I know. Amen to that.
If I could just write to KJ Charles and be like, hey, could listen.
You job, please? And KJ, like, I gotcha. Dude, I gotcha.
As you might have guessed, Bannon's writing was inspired by Meeker's Spring Fire, as well as The Well of Loneliness by Radcliffe Hall.
Mm-hmm.
A much more downer book about lesbians in the 20s.
Ah.
It's also inspired by all of the lesbian longing she has to repress in her marriage to her unsupportive husband.
Yeah.
Because she has no lived experience in lesbian relationships, she takes research trips to Greenwich Village to meet and befriend real-life lesbians in the wild.
Research done right.
Odd Girl Out becomes the second best-selling paperback of 1957. Much like Spring Fire, it's about sorority girls falling in love with each other. Unlike Spring Fire, thanks to newly relaxed obscenity laws, it ends with the protagonist embracing her lesbianism.
Nice.
It also begins the Bebo Brinker Chronicles.
The what now?
The Bebo Brinker Chronicles.
Alright, this is great, but I'm just gonna get, like, a quick critique for names. Bebo Brinker doesn't exactly...
It's amazing! It's the greatest name of all time! It is the most superior name ever produced in fiction. I quite agree, Dee. Go on.
Yeah, but it's not... It doesn't have a doctor in front of it. How can I trust this Bebo Brinker?
Oh my god, Dr. Bebo Brinker.
Dr. Bebo Brinker.
There is no name I trust more.
I would give my life into Dr. Bebo Brinker's hands.
Gladly.
Okay. So, tell me more about these Bebo Brinkers.
Alright. So, Odd Girl Out begins the Bebo Brinker Chronicles. However, Bebo Brinker herself does not appear until book two.
There's just this, like, I can see and I bet everyone can hear when you try to collect yourself to say that without stuttering or like, mixing the letters up. You're just like, I gotta nail Bebo Brinker every time.
It's important! This is history!
Okay, so who is Bebo Brinker?
In 1959, we get a book with the title modeled after Fallout Boy. I am a woman, opening parentheses, in love with a woman, dash, must society reject me, question mark, closing parentheses.
Oh, that's my favorite Panic at the Disco song.
Bebo Brinker is a minor character in I Am a Woman. She steals the show because she's a 6-foot-tall butch lesbian.
Well, yeah.
In an era where women weren't permitted to be anything but feminine, as evidenced by the book covers for the series, which always depict Bebo as an average 50s housewife.
Huh.
So completely unlike how she actually is between the covers, because the authors had absolutely zero control over the covers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Also a problem that continues this day.
To quote Bannon herself, I put Bebo together just as I wanted her, in my heart and mind. She was just, quite literally, the butch of my dreams.
Amen.
I mean, you know. Bebo really, really, really strikes a chord with the lesbian community of the 1950s.
Oh, you mean the 6-foot-tall dream butch?
Yeah, for some reason they're really into that.
I can't imagine.
So not only do they meet the butch of their dreams, but they see themselves depicted in fiction for the first time with happy endings.
I could imagine, like, going bonkers and yonkers for that, yeah.
Butches ever after.
Beautiful.
I'm gonna go ahead and attribute Bebo Brinker's popularity to the extensive hands-on research Bannon conducted amongst the real lesbian community in Grand Village. Because I feel like she walked into a lesbian bar, saw a striking, beautiful, handsome butch.
Yeah, 6-foot-tall, handsome butch.
Collapsed on the ground. Witnessed all the other women in the bar collapsing on the ground. Yeah. And was like, I think there's something compelling here.
Was tenderly revived by said handsome butch.
You know. And just like Meeker before her, Bannon starts getting letters from grateful lesbians.
Yeah, honestly, same. God bless you for this big, beautiful butch.
To quote Bannon again, the most important things they learned from the books were that 1, they weren't unique and doomed to lifelong isolation, 2, they weren't abnormal, and 3, there was hope for a happy life.
I'm feeling like it, like that moment is also just like when everyone saw Sailor Uranus for the first time.
Yes.
Man, I wish you could see Ken's face. Very
life-changing.
Yeah, just everyone kind of like learned something in that moment.
1959. The next book in the Bebo Brinker Chronicles.
Was that like a normal name at the time?
No!
Were women named Bebo?
No! The 50s were insane, but they weren't that insane. It is more controversial and less popular because it's kind of an issue fic.
Ah.
It tries to cover interracial relationships, self-loathing based on race, sexuality, abuse, alcoholism, violence, jealousy, etc., all at the same time.
Oh, so the author was working through some stuff.
Author was working through some shit, and also people came to the Bebo Brinker Chronicles for Happy Butch Ever After. So getting a real serious book did not go over well.
Wow, that's very complicated. I can see. There's a part of me that wants to be like, let the author explore what the author needs to explore, and the other part going like, but I see the need for the escapism.
Yeah.
And I understand the disappointment.
And also, I feel like, I mean, I want to say that interracial relationships are less controversial today, but...
Very thin margin.
Yeah, because the 50s, as you might, you know, remember from history class, are pre-civil rights movement. So, yeah. Went over like a lead balloon.
Well, yeah, I was gonna say, it's like very punchy for the time, like...
It's incredibly controversial for the time, and for now, but, you know.
I mean, kudos to her for writing about it.
Yeah, she gave it a shot.
It was more than a lot of people were willing to do.
1959. It also depicts a lesbian marrying a gay man and both attempting to pass as a heterosexual couple. So...
It's like Will and Grace, like...
Yeah, it is 1950s Will and Grace.
It's just the thing, like, I feel like there is, like, a positive, fun way to do that.
There is, but it's not this book.
It's not this one, okay. It's also not Will and Grace, don't anyone get me wrong.
1960, book 4, Journey to a Woman.
This is my favorite Jules Verne.
It features, amongst other things, a closeted lesbian writing to a lesbian pulp fiction author for advice.
Where do they get these ideas, these authors?
Where do you come up with this stuff? Also, Bebo, so much Bebo, everyone's in love.
I'm losing my mind over the name Bebo.
It's amazing. 1960, The Marriage. It does feature the same lesbian cast as previous Bebo books, but the plot, instead of being about lesbians, is about a straight couple who realize they're brother and sister.
What?
V.C. Andrews.
Yeah, I was literally just gonna be like, is this also V.C. Andrews?
No. It's just out of fucking nowhere.
This is like somewhere George R.R. Martin's waking up in a cold goddamn sweat.
1962, we get the final book in the Bebo Brinker Chronicles, titled Bebo Brinker
is President.
God, if only. It is a prequel starring the character everyone really cares about.
Nice.
A young butch's journey of self-discovery.
Swoon. I really like that the previous book was like, heterosexuality, is it incredibly bad? Yes. Next question. It feels like those, like, Go Ask Alice warning books about lesbians, but in reverse, where it's just like, what's wrong with heterosexuality, do you ask?
You could marry your brother.
Your brother is a man. Disgusting. Like...
Listen, if you let the straights marry, they'll do it.
They will do it. It doesn't matter. Like, it's just all this abuse of man and a woman, huh? No rules. Just right. Outback Straight House.
Yes! Outback Straight House.
That's the part you picked up on. Huh? I was off the cuff. I wasn't even sitting on that one.
God.
But real talk, I gotta give respect to her for clowning on straight relationships the way they like the way it's always been in reverse.
Anyway,
Outback Straight House.
Also in 1962, Bannon's husband decides she's having too much fun and puts his foot down on her lesbian writing career.
Oh.
So Bannon's writing comes to a halt.
So when I get a time machine,
I've still got 5 pages.
Oh, okay.
1957. Going back a few years.
Okay.
So we can talk about Whisper Their Love by Valerie Taylor.
That's very classic sounding.
Published through Gold Medal Books. Who is Valerie Taylor?
A lesbian. I'm going to go on a limb and say...
Indeed. Not the shark expert of the same name.
Oh, that's right. Valerie Taylor is a shark expert.
Yes. A different Valerie Taylor from this one. This Valerie Taylor is a lesbian romance lot.
Sharks are lesbians.
I mean, we knew that. Have you seen Deep Blue?
Have you seen Parthenogenesis?
Ooh. Valerie Taylor identifies as both bisexual and lesbian.
Okay.
She realized her attraction to women in her 30s, used the $500 earned from her first non-lesbian book to divorce her abusive alcoholic husband.
Fuck yeah.
And in 1957, we get her first lesbian novel, Whisper Their Love. Quote, I began writing gay novels around 1957. There was suddenly a plethora of them on sale in drugstores and bookstores. Many written by men who had never knowingly spoken to a lesbian. Wish fulfillment stuff, pure erotic daydreaming. I wanted to make some money, of course, but I also thought that we should have some stories about real people.
Aww.
She continues writing lesbian pulp through the 50s and 60s, including 1959, The Girls in 3B, 1960, Strangers on Lesbos, 1963, A World Without Men, 1963, Unlike Others, and also in 1963, Return to Lesbos.
Once you go to Lesbos,
you have to go back.
You are called back to its shores.
Which brings us into the late 60s.
Okay, things suck, but in a different way now.
Free love movement and sexual revolution in general create a safer, relatively, environment for same-sex couples to exist outside of pulp fiction.
Okay.
As lesbians begin to form their own societies, publishing companies, and presses, demand for lesbian pulp dies down. Which is good for lesbian representation in fiction because the authors are no longer beholden to the draconian editorial terms of non-lesbian publishing houses.
Yeah.
Lesbians are now publishing fiction by lesbians for lesbians. It's a good thing.
Martha Stewart.
Hashtag thanks, Martha.
2019.
No.
Lesbians are good. Martha said gay rights.
Did she?
You know, remind me to Google that later.
Okay. 1980s. Speaking of lesbian presses, Naiad Press.
Oh, that's a very good name.
It is. They start tracking down lesbian pulp authors and offering to republish their work.
Aww.
Anne Bannon is shocked anyone is still interested in her books.
Aww.
She's divorced by this point, and a college professor. She's concerned about how the revelation of her previous writing career will be received by academia. But rather than a shunning, she gets a boost in popularity.
Nice!
Quote, people stared at me around campus, and the PE majors all waved.
Oh boy.
My chairman told me to put the books into my promotion file, and one of my colleagues told me my file was the only one that was any fun.
Okay, well that's good.
In 1983, Naiad Press offers Patricia Highsmith $5,000 to reprint The Price of Salt, or $2,000 to republish it under a pseudonym.
Oh.
Highsmith takes the latter offer, resulting in a 1984 edition with an afterword.
Oh. So Naiad Press is really out there doing the good work.
Yeah. On October 22nd, 1997, Valerie Taylor dies at the age of 84, after a lifetime of activism and having continued writing into her 80s.
Nice.
Yes.
Thank you, Valerie.
Thank you, Valerie. In 2004, Clace Press releases Spring Fire by Mary Jane Meeker. Meeker fought the reprinting at first due to her shame and embarrassment regarding the very downer ending.
Oh, that's understandable, yeah.
When she finally agreed to reprint, she added a foreword explaining the circumstances surrounding the original publication that dictated its content.
That's great!
And in 2015...
Whoa, big jump.
We get the movie Carol.
They're lesbians, Harold.
They're lesbians, Harold! It's a movie adaptation of The Price of Salt by Patricia Highsmith.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
Oh my god.
65 years later, critically acclaimed, Academy Award nominated, and a massive success.
But everyone who like didn't let that happen the first time fucking kicking themselves.
And it, as D has already spoiled, it birthed the Harold They're Lesbians meme. Which, if you don't exist exclusively in LGBT spaces on the internet, was someone had attended a screening of Carol and sat near an elderly straight couple. And at a certain point in the film, the woman turned to her husband and said, Harold, they're lesbians.
Well, I'll give them the one thing is that the promotional material for Carol was what I'm going to call evasive.
I would say coy.
Evasive is too strong a word. It was very coy. And I think that's got more to do with like making a classy preview than trying to trick people.
It's that, and also, I feel like it was only coy if you were straight.
Definitely, yeah.
Because everyone who wasn't straight saw, like, the first 5 seconds of that trailer and was like, Lesbians! Harold, they're lesbians!
Yeah, I can see them! Yeah, but it was definitely, there was definitely a huge bunch of people who went to see it who weren't kind of in on the not a secret.
That weren't in on the complete non-twist.
Yeah, who were in on the, like, outward premise of the movie.
Which brings us to today.
I'm here.
We are. Welcome. The future. It's full of lesbians. Lesbian pulp still resonates with lesbian readers.
Good.
It is highly collectible.
Yeah, yeah.
With a steep price increase, not only because of the strong interest in it, but also because pulp paper was never intended to last more than a year. These books were intended to be thrown away, and those that weren't thrown away are very fragile.
Yeah.
So there's not a whole lot to go around.
They're a rarity on a lot of fronts.
So, quick price check. The price is salt. You want it.
I do.
1952 hardcover Coward McCann first edition will cost you between $1,750 or $3,750.
Hachi machi.
Depending on condition. The 1953 pulp paperback edition from Bantam Books could run you between $750 and like $900.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wow.
They're historically significant first editions.
They are.
Bebo Brinker. Signed first editions, $400 to $500.
Okay.
Naiad Press editions from the 80s, so significantly later printing, are still worth about $40.
I'm gonna go get a $40 copy.
There are also, like, much, much more recent editions that you could get for, like, $5. If you just want to read the damn things, you can find them.
But I want your local
library.
I want the vintage.
I know you want the vintage. The Evil Friendship. First edition goes for $39. Odd Girl Out. I could only find a second printing for $49. Spring Fire goes from between $5 or $20, depending on condition, or from one ambitious seller, $125.
Okay, well, buddy, you're reaching.
Women's Barracks, $5 to $12 for a paperback, but these are like the more recent printings. $40 plus for the hardcover.
No.
And The Lesbian by Dr. Benjamin Morse.
$6 through $30
depending on condition.
Eat my whole ass, Dr. Benjamin.
And that's all I have to say on lesbians. I'm joking. I have so much more to say about lesbians, but for now.
Yeah.
Lesbians is good. Lesbians is good. Women loving is good.
If you are in the New England area and you've got the scratch, Basement Books in Providence has an extensive collection of lesbian pulp. Ken, I will be taking you there to see it. They are expensive. They're in the hundreds to 200 range. They are rare copies. But hey, I do know a place to get it.
Was there a place in P-Town as well?
Yeah, half of it.
Okay.
And most of North... P-Town, put that on the Facebook. I can't remember the names of the... This is a shop in P-Town. I don't know if there's anything in Northampton anymore.
I think the shop in Northampton closed down, sadly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Support your LGBT bookstores. Please. So this doesn't happen.
Keep them alive. Keep them going.
Love them.
Love them. Appreciate them. Purchase. But yeah, there's a couple of antique shops in P-Town where they do specialize in pulps of all kinds.
Nice.
And those are the two I know about. There's also a place in Wellfleet, but I have to get back to you on the name on that place.
Right on.
They really love selling copies of The Giggling Granny, too. Because of course.
All right. Sources for this episode include Autostraddle.
That doesn't surprise me.
For those of you not in the know, Autostraddle is the premier women-loving women lifestyle place on the internet. Rivaled only by After Ellen, and even then by, like, a slim margin. Yeah. Autostraddle. Check it out, won't you?
They're also very inclusive.
Yes. Refreshingly inclusive. There's also the CollectorsWeekly.com article, When Being a Lesbian Was Profitable for Men.
Surprisingly astute approach.
And also, Wikipedia. Just so much Wikipedia.
Please consider throwing in a few bucks every round of donations.
Donate to Wikipedia. If you would like to talk to us about lesbian pulp fiction or just want to say hey, you can email us directly at antiquesfreakspodcast@gmail.com. Or you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/antiquesfreaks. And from there, you can join our Facebook group, Antiques Freaks Friends, where we will be posting pulp covers.
Oh, we will.
If you would like to check out a wide variety of vintage goods, we have our Etsy shop at etsy.com/shop/antiquesfreaks.
Once I stop crying, I will get my books up there.
D is working through some estate sale purchases.
Oh, my cup runneth over. I realize half my collection's in German. For reasons even I couldn't begin to elaborate, I don't speak German.
Rammstein.
Well, I don't speak German well.
Rammstein.
I don't speak 19th century German well.
You speak 17th century German.
17th century American German.
Speak Pennsylvania Dutch.
Pennsylvania Dutch, yeah. So if you need that translated, it's hard, and you will get a very weird response. But yeah, so if you're excited about some German copies of books, I'm probably going to be unloading my German collection, because I can't read it.
If you would like to check out some deleted scenes, you can hit up our Patreon at patreon.com/antiquesfreaks.
That is not in German.
It is not. And you can also join the Random Vintage Postcard of the Month Club, where we send you a random vintage postcard every month.
Jury's out on whether or not that'll be German.
No. It won't. Special shout out to our current patrons for helping us pay our hosting fees and getting us ever closer to a second microphone and releasing bonus episodes.
The dream.
To dream. The impossible dream.
If you donate enough, I'll get Ken to keep doing that.
No.
On the Patreon.
You're the one with the vocalist background. You sing.
But then people have to find out that I wasn't actually good at it.
And thank you for listening.
You beautiful creature.
Especially you. Goodbye.
Bye.